And I get to speak after someone who actually talks faster than I do, which is a change. So that slide, that last slide that you had from Michael is actually what I'm going to be talking about, which is screening for HIV and hepatitis C in the dental setting. It also might help if I brought my glasses. In middle age, is that a new risk factor? So, middle age. So,
forgetting your glasses is.
Forgetting your glasses is. Okay, so this is learning objectives. I did put a disclosure that I don't have any, my point is right here, I see it. Any relationship with the pharmaceutical companies are involved in this. It has been 32 years since the first reported cases of HIV and AIDS, which is pretty remarkable since many of us on this panel have been involved in it since the very beginning. And one of the issues that we have is too many people are learning their status late, and that comes into multiple factors. First, about 18% of the people with HIV in the U.S. who are infected actually are not aware that they're infected. If you're not aware that you're infected, you're going to continue the behaviors that put you and others at risk. The second thing is that people who learn their status, a lot of them don't come back in. 31% who get a regular HIV test don't come back for their results, and about a third of the people who were diagnosed with HIV in 2008 were diagnosed with AIDS. So we actually have two different, I think the only disease that actually has two different names. We have HIV infection, which if you get into care, you can actually have a normal, long life. But we also have too many of our patients that are showing up at Grady Hospital, which is where I'm from, who have advanced disease with CMV retinitis and colitis and all the things that we saw in the early 80s are still presenting today, and that's a problem. So we need to be able to identify people early. In the 2006, the CDC changed the recommendations. It used to be based on risk factor, so you would look at somebody and determine they might be at risk versus somebody that might not be at risk, and that wasn't working. So they said that routine testing should occur at least once a year for those ages 13 to 64 who are sexually active. As I'm getting older, I think that 64 number needs to go up, but that's a whole other thing. Repeated annually for high-risk groups. They're actually getting ready to modify that statement and say every 3 to 6 months for men who have sex with men who are with multiple partners. Eliminate the pretest counseling portion. I have a slide on that coming up in a minute, and get rid of the separate consent because it was perceived to be a barrier. Why is this so important? The science of discovery of the year by Science Magazine in 2011 was HPTN-052, or HIV Prevention Trials Network 052, which looked at serodiscordant couples. So that's one person is HIV infected, the other is HIV negative. They found that those who were on antiretroviral therapy and had undetectable viral load were 96% less likely to infect the other person. And that's key. For us to get rid of this disease globally, we're actually going to have to change some behaviors because the vaccine isn't anytime soon. There have been some new breakthroughs, but it's still at least 10 years away. So if we can get people into care, keep them on care, and have them have undetectable viral load, the risk of transmission goes greatly down. But we first need to get people into care, and that's what I'm going to talk about. I did write a chapter for Dental Clinics of North America for Ira Lamster, and he wanted me to put this section in the chapter, referral for HIV testing based on oral lesions. So if you don't know that a person has HIV infection, they show up with pseudomembranous candidiasis, it may be indicative of HIV infection, but it's not diagnostic. There are no oral manifestations that are diagnostic of HIV infection. All of the things that I see basically still on a daily basis could be due to uncontrolled diabetes, neutropenia, several different risk factors. So if you do see somebody, what would be the appropriate status? You can treat the candidiasis, that's pretty easy, and then refer to a primary care provider for comprehensive workup, including HIV testing. However, as someone who was in the private sector in the 80s when HIV first started to show up in Atlanta, you could say refer all you want, and people didn't go. I mean, that was the biggest issue, and there's a difference. In those days, there were no treatment. We could not make this a chronic disease. Today, with the advances we've had in medication and in research, we actually, if we get people into care, it becomes a chronic disease, but they have to get into care early enough. So one of the things I wanted to say about this, it's not in agreement with CDC's 2006 guidelines. And that's true. We really want people to know their status. However, it is at least is something that the dental profession could do, is if you see someone who has an oral lesion or persistent aphthous ulcers that don't clear up on away, or they have erythematous or pseudomembranous candidiasis, yes, you can go ahead and treat the condition and refer. But what were the national HIV-AIDS strategy? And it was really sort of interesting. When I was on the Presidential Advisory Council, we started PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And during that, every country that received funds from the United States had to have a national HIV and AIDS strategy. However, the U.S. didn't have one until this was published in 2010, so I think that's sort of interesting. So what were the three primary goals? Is to reduce HIV incidence, increase access to care, optimizing health outcomes, and reducing HIV-related health disparities. So the National HIV-AIDS Strategy calls for an increase from 79% who knew their status to 90%. And this has to be done by 2015, and regretfully, we're falling behind. Right now, about 82% know their status. We have a long way to go. It's going to take more than the traditional methods for HIV screening to get to this goal. So I think I'm going to be doing a few slides that Barbara just covered, but we are a unique setting. There are millions, like Barbara said, of people who go to the dentist in a year who do not see a physician, and we can be a site that can actually do some testing and referral. Again, looking at a study that was published by Harold Pollack, Lisa Metch, and Steve Abel, we found that if you look at NHANES, there are 3.6 million Americans who report they're at significant risk for HIV infection but have never been tested, and that's a lot of people. Patient attitude. So what do we think about people getting an HIV test in the dental setting? One of the first places to do this was actually the KC Free Health Center in Kansas City, Missouri. And they looked at 150 patients, and of that, 73% were willing to take a free oral fluid screening test in the dental setting, and Dr. Spitt will cover that a little bit more thoroughly. A patient attitude at NYU, the largest provider of low-cost dental care in New York State, revealed that 74% would accept an HIV test as if it was offered as a part of a dental visit. What are some of our concerns? How do you give the results? Now remember, we can't diagnose HIV. We're only screening for HIV. So we're getting a preliminary reactive, which has to be followed up by a confirmatory test. The need for professionals to claim, to counsel, to address psychosocial concerns. And one of the things that we did in KC Free is actually we did get a preliminary reactive, and we had several, was to have a counselor and tester on call so that person after the preliminary, because you have 20 minutes during that period of time, at least with oral fluid, that we could get somebody down there to take that so it wouldn't interrupt with dental flow. And then the key is linking people to confirmatory testing and care. If you look at the United States HIV cascade, we know that about 82% know their status. Of that, about 77% are actually linked to care. Where the United States is really falling down are the percentage of people who are retained in care. It's only around 37%. And the definition of being retained in care were two primary care visits 3 months apart within a 12-month period of time. So basically, going to the doctor twice a year, and only 37% or so. And that leads to a bigger problem, which is that only 25% of people with HIV in the U.S. have undetectable viral load. Again, go back to that HPT and 052 study showing why that's important. So, there's a new study that just came out looking at, is it necessary to do pretest counseling, and what we find if you did studies that, we studied two patient populations, one that did get pretest counseling and one that didn't, and would there be any differences? And what they found was no significant differences looking at any specific sexually transmitted infection, and we also looked at, the group looked at subgroups including age, ethnicity, gender, or substance use. There are no differences between the intervention and control groups in terms of number of partners and amount of unprotected sex that they reported. The financial analysis showed that it was $23 to test each person in the control group which did not get counseling versus 56 in those receiving extra counseling. This is a very important study that was just recently released. So in action, I want to talk a little bit about Harlem Hospital, Institute Counselor-Based HIV Screening Initiative and their dental clinic. As patients waited for their dental appointment, a trained counselor tested 3,500 patients at 97.6% acceptance rate, which is pretty incredible. They found 50 newly diagnosed cases, six of whom had an AIDS-defining condition or illness. Their CD4 count was less than 200. So counselor-based HIV screening with linkage to primary care can be successfully implemented. Now, this is something I'm very proud of. I've done some work in Wyoming. The first dental clinic, or one of the first dental clinics in the United States to screen for HIV, actually was in Casper, Wyoming, of all places. And New York City is the other. So of all the places in the world, Casper, Wyoming, and Anna Kinder, who is the AIDS Education and Training Center director in Wyoming, actually led this effort. So I've lectured there on several occasions, just came back, got new boots, sort of fun. And I talked at the Dental Hygiene Association meeting there, and I met this other young lady, Tobin, who was planning on, in a few years ago, planning on instituting HIV screening as a part of the curriculum in a dental hygiene school. So what I was able to witness when I was there lecturing were dental hygiene students actually screening dental hygienists at the statewide meeting for HIV. And this is actually the testing in progress. This was, they did give me permission for their pictures. I'm very, very proud of this because here you have a dental hygiene school that's doing what a lot of dental schools are not doing across the country, and hopefully it'll set the example for other programs. I'm very proud of this effort. So linkage, I've already talked about it, is remarkably important. You have to have relationships in place. Just like you would have relationships in place for a post-exposure prophylaxis, you shouldn't be sending people to the emergency room if somebody has an exposure. You have to have relationships if you have an HIV, if you have a preliminary reactive. So it could be a private practice infectious disease physician. It could be a Ryan White funded program. Ryan White, for those who don't know, pays for uninsured, underinsured care in the U.S., including oral health care. I'm also very proud of that, and we need to keep that as we work through the Affordable Care Act and Ryan White reauthorization. A community health center with experience in managing HIV disease, because not all community health centers want to manage HIV disease, a free clinic, and linkage to care to an HIV counselor. Those are all important, and that's extremely important if you're going to undertake this effort. So that's HIV. So what about Hep C? Well, Ira didn't specifically, he said screen for infectious diseases. I decided we needed to include hepatitis C as well. There is a point of care hepatitis C test now available. The oral fluid test has been delayed. But hepatitis C is the most common bloodborne infection in the U.S. with 3.2 million people chronically infected. It's termed the silent epidemic. It's the leading cause of liver disease, cirrhosis, and death. It's most prevalent amongst the baby boomers, and the CDC came out with a recommendation, I believe it was this year, that all people who were born during the baby boom generation, 1945 to 1965, and that does include me, who were likely infected in the 70s and the 80s. Now, I sort of missed out on that because I was in school being a nerd, but apparently there was a whole bunch of things that were going on in the 70s and the 80s. People were trying injections. Is that true, Dan? People were trying injecting drugs. So we have some groups that are going to be much more likely, people that are injection drug users. Tattoo parlors are actually a mode of transmission. And you really, if you're everybody, I see that not everybody, but a lot of young people today are getting tattoos. If you're a parent and you have kids, are you going to do a public health message? Make sure they have standard infection control procedures going on. So we really know that IDUs account for approximately 1/3 of the people who are HCV infected, but the prevalence is highest in the undiagnosed group, which is the baby boomers. Others at risk are people who got donated blood products before 1992. We really hadn't cleaned up the blood supply of clotting factor before 1987. That's why we saw so many hemophiliacs with HIV in the early parts of the epidemic. Chronic hemodialysis patients, we're seeing an increase, especially in minority communities. Needle stick injuries in healthcare settings. I'm not aware of any cases where hepatitis C has been transferred from a patient to a healthcare provider, but in Tulsa, Oklahoma, they did have the first case of patient-to-patient transmission because an oral surgery office there completely disregarded standard infection control procedures, and when you do that, you're going to end up with a problem. Birth from HCV-infected mother, and people living with HIV and AIDS. For years, they basically preached the only way that you could get hepatitis C was through direct blood, like a needle sharing or things of that sort, that sex was not a component, and now they're realizing that unprotected sex is actually something that is involved. So since 2007, because we've seen these advances in HIV treatment, hepatitis C has surpassed HIV as a cause of death in the U.S. Between 1999 and 2007, recorded deaths increased to about 15,000. During the same time, the deaths from HIV declined to 12,000, which is a blessing. So there's other factors that are listing there, including alcohol-related conditions and HIV co-infection. So I already talked about CDC recommending that. How many people have been tested for hepatitis C here? Not very many. So you really should, especially if you were doing some things in the 70s and the 80s. Okay. So it should be recommended for routine screening, and why it's going to cause a tremendous burden on our Medicare system as we go along. 50 to 75% of people living with chronic hepatitis C do not know they are infected. So you might want to get that little test, because it does say silent. It's actually called the silent epidemic. Compared to present recommendations, the birth cohort screening would identify over 800,000 cases, 96% of all undiagnosed cases in the birth cohort, compared to 21% under risk-based screening. If you did something once in the 70s and you don't think that you're at risk, you're at risk. If you did something once in the 80s and you don't think you're at risk, you're at risk. So impact on public health. Without new HCV testing strategies, the impact of chronic hepatitis C is going to be a huge problem. It's the number one reason for liver transplantation in the United States. And if you look at the cost of the cost on Medicare, and we always hear about all of the Medicare financial struggles, the people who are going to need liver transplants and are going to be ill from hepatitis C most likely will be on Medicare at the time of diagnosis and treatment. So why do we use point-of-care testing? I think Barbara did a great job of doing that, but it gives the ability of places that are not traditional, like going to your primary care office for your free, now mandated by the Affordable Care Act, preventive care. So it gives you another place to actually identify folks and get them into care, and we do need new strategies to identify people that are at risk for HIV or at risk for hepatitis C. So here's a question. I am a dentist performing finger sticks for blood glucose. It really should be hemoglobin A1C. I completely agree with Barbara on that. But this is the slide I have. In my office as part of a patient's visit, am I considered to have a laboratory, and do I need a CLIA certificate or a CLIA waiver? How many people think the answer is no, I'm just taking a finger stick for blood glucose, I don't need to get a CLIA waiver? How many people think the answer is yes? How many people are already asleep and don't have any opinion on the question? And look, the asleep people really raised their hand. That's pretty remarkable. The answer is yes. And this is very important. I've lectured at dental schools across the country that are doing these tests that have no clue that they need to have a CLIA waiver. I know private practice dentists, especially implant dentists and periodontists, who are doing glucose tests that don't really realize they need to have a CLIA waiver. It's a very simple procedure to do. It's basically you fill out a form and you submit your money. You estimate the number of tests you're going to do during the year. A CLIA waiver or WAVE tests that are simple laboratory examinations and procedures that have an insignificant risk of erroneous result. In other words, even I can do that and not screw it up. The Food and Drug Administration is who determines who gets CLIA waived and who doesn't. For a list of WAVE tests, and I guess these presentations will be online, you can actually go and click this and it'll give you which tests are waived and which aren't. You can enroll in CLIA by simply going to cms.gov, that site's working these days, and forward your completed application. You probably need to contact your state agency because different states have different regulations. These are some different insurances, resources that you can look. You can look at quality assurance. You can look at HIV Dent. That's a promo. Because we have a whole section on HIV testing. We haven't renamed it yet, but it is going to be HIV and hepatitis C testing in the near future. There's a compendium of state testing laws on HIV that you can look at to see who has what kinds of information. And then if you have questions that dawn on you when you leave, you can contact us through hivdent.org or through HIV Dent's Facebook page. Helene is the vice president, and I'm the president of that organization, and we will get our responses back to you. Thank you, and next up is Dr. Malamud.
Hello, pharmacist.